Floyd gestured to his shoulder. Thomas's eyebrows went up theatrically, as if to say, "Oh, yeah." He unstrapped the tube, extended it, and flipped up the sight. The rocket turned the courtyard into a ball of fire. Sergeant Watson saw Thomas exulting over the shot, the same man who had been so upset about Fillmore minutes before. He solved his problem. It was inspiring for Watson to see how determined and resilient men could be. Specialist Mike Kurth was helping to bandage Errico when he saw a grenade drop and roll out past him. Its smoke trail first caught his eye, then he saw the pineapple shape on the ground, right next to the hump in the road hiding Colette. "Grenade!" sounded several voices together. The men, Kurth, Errico, Nethery, and Doc Strauss, all flopped to the sand and rolled as fast as they could. Private Jeff Young reached back to grab Strauss and pull him away, and the explosion ripped the medic from his hands. When it blew, Kurth felt himself driven hard into the ground and felt a flash of heat and light behind him. He was in just the right spot. The force of the explosion passed over him. He felt the shock and heat of it and tasted its bitter chemical ignition, but in the frantic instants after the blast, he moved his arms and legs and saw that he hadn't been hurt. The rest of the guys could not have been so lucky. Colette for sure was dead. Kurth sat up hesitantly before the smoke had cleared. "Doc, you good?" he asked. "Yeah." "Nethery?" "Yeah." "Errico?" "Yeah." "Young?" "I'm okay." He waited to name Colette last. "Yeah, dude, I'm okay," his friend answered. The hump in the road had directed the blast up and away from him. Strauss got some shrapnel in one leg, and Young caught a small piece in his boot, but otherwise everyone was intact. Further down the slope on the sunny side of the street, just beyond a tin shack that jutted out from one of the houses, Captain Steele was still on the ground with his second-in-command, Lechner, and Atwater, his radio man. Sergeant Hooten was in the doorway to a courtyard about 10 feet to Steele's right. It looked like he was trying to get the captain's attention. Floyd saw the barrel of an M-16 protrude from behind the corner down his side of the street, pointing at the two Ranger officers. Chapter 14. What Hooten was trying to tell Steele was that he'd chosen a bad place to stop. Fillmore and one of the other operators had just been shot in that spot. Steele motioned with his hand for Hooten to wait. He was talking on the radio. He wondered where in the hell the vehicles were. At the same time, Steele's Rangers and the Delta operators had been running through the streets, making their way to the first crash site. The ground convoy was wandering, lost, and taking terrible casualties. But Steele didn't know this. All he knew was that they had left the target house at the same time. Steele and some of his men had been pinned down now for about 10 minutes. If those vehicles would show up, they could all roll out of this mess. Besides Steele, Lechner and Atwater were working out some fire support. They had trouble at first because the signal from Atwater's UHF radio was being overridden by the UHF emergency beacon from the downed Black Hawk a block away. Lechner was finally able to get through to one of the attack little birds on his FM radio. The pilot, Chief Warrant Officer Hal Wade, told Lechner to put out some big orange panels marking their positions. Lechner passed the word. Once the panels were placed on the road, Wade came roaring down Marahan Road, just above the low rooftops. Colette ducked his helmet into his chest. Gunfire erupted from all directions as the little bird flashed past, but the helicopter didn't fire. Wade was braving the fire to make sure he knew where his own forces were before shooting back. His chopper flew up and swept into a turn and came roaring back down the road again. There was another rattling explosion of gunfire, but once again, Wade didn't shoot. He now had a pretty good fix on where his people were on the ground. Wade's little bird made another sweeping turn. This time, when he came down, his miniguns were blazing. It was just after that first shooting run that a bullet sprayed sand into Steele's eye. Lechner turned left. He thought the shot came from across the road, but Steele rolled to his right and looked at the tin wall behind him. The shot had rung so loud he was certain it had come from there. His first thought was that one of the wounded rangers behind him was shooting through the wall. He kept rolling away, which wasn't easy with the big radio strapped to his back. Then two more holes poked through the tin with loud bangs, and dirt flew, and Lechner screamed. He first felt a whipping sensation, and then a crushing blow, as if an anvil had fallen on the lower half of his leg. The pain was unbearable. He gripped his upper leg and looked down at a gaping hole in his leg. The bullet had exploded his shin bone and traveled on down his leg and exited at his ankle, shredding the foot beneath the hole. There had been three rounds. Steele and Atwater had reacted to the first by rolling away, but Lechner had not. Steele was rolling when he heard Lechner scream. There was more shooting. Hooten gesticulated wildly in the doorway, waving Steele in. Atwater was between Lechner and him, and the doorway was close, so Steele got up and ran for it. There was a lip around the base of the entrance, and he tripped over it. The big captain came sprawling into the courtyard. Atwater came flying in after him. Steele saw Atwater and shouted, "We've got to get Lechner!" He stood to run back out, but saw the howling lieutenant, his leg a mess, being dragged toward the door by Bullock, who had run out to the street to help. Steele took the radio mic from Atwater. Shouting, his words delivered in gasped phrases, his voice contrasted sharply with the even, cool voices of the pilots and airborne commanders, reflecting the drama on the ground. "Romeo 6-4, this is Juliet 6-4. We're taking heavy small arms fire. We need relief now and start extracting." Harrell responded evenly, but with impatience. "This is Romeo 6-4. I understand you need to be extracted. I've done everything I can to get those vehicles to you. Over." Steele spoke wearily. "Roger, understand. Be advised. Command element," Lechner, "was just hit. Have more casualties. Over." Sergeant Goodale, who had been pulled into the same courtyard earlier after being shot through the thigh and buttock, had heard Lechner howl. It was a horrible sound, the worst sound he'd ever heard a man make. His own wound, oddly, didn't hurt that bad. Lechner's looked horrific. He was still screaming when they got him inside. Goodale helped to pull the lieutenant's radio off. Minutes before, after his injury, Goodale had radioed Lechner to tell him he would be unable to continue calling in air support. That's why Lechner had been calling Wade. Now, here the lieutenant was, screaming in agony, the upper part of his right leg normal, but the bottom half, from just below the knee, flopped grotesquely to one side. He was ghost white. Goodale sickened more as he saw a widening pool form under the leg. Blood flowed from Lechner's wound like it was pouring from a jug. Chapter 15. At roughly the same time, 1.5 miles southwest, his helicopter pancaked into a squalid village of cloth and tin huts. Blackhawk Super 6-4 pilot Mike Durant came to. There was something wrong with his right leg. He and his co-pilot, Ray Frank, had been knocked cold for at least several minutes. They weren't sure how long. Durant was upright, leaning slightly to the right. The windshield was shattered, and there was something draped over him, a big sheet of tin. The Blackhawk seemed remarkably intact. The rotor blades had not flexed off. His seat, which was mounted on shock absorbers, had collapsed down to the floor. It had broken in the full down position and was cocked to the right. He figured that was because he had been spinning when they hit. The shocks had collapsed, and the spin jerked the seat to the right. It must have been the combination of the jerk and the impact that had broken his femur. The big bone in his right leg had snapped on the edge of his seat. The Black Hawk had flattened a flimsy hut. No one had been inside, but in the hut alongside, a 2-year-old girl, Hawa Hassan, lay unconscious and bleeding. A hunk of flying metal from the helicopter had taken a deep gouge out of her forehead. Her mother, Bint Abraham Hassan, had been splashed with something hot, probably oil, and was severely burned on her face and legs. The dazed pilots checked themselves over. Frank's left tibia was broken. Durant did some things he later could not explain. He removed his helmet and his gloves. Then he took off his watch. Before flying, he always took off his wedding ring, because there was a danger it could catch on rivets or switches. He would pass the strap of his watch through the ring and keep it there during a flight. Now he removed the watch and took the ring off the strap and set both on the dashboard. He picked up his weapon, an MP5K, a little German 9mm submachine gun. The pilots called them SPs, or skinny poppers. Frank tried to explain what happened during the crash. "I couldn't get them all the way off," he said, explaining his struggle to reach up and pull the power control levers back as they fell. Frank said he had re-injured his back. He had hurt it first in the crash years before. Durant's back hurt, too. They both figured they had crushed vertebrae. All this happened in the first moments after they came to. Durant realized that with his leg and back broken, he would be unable to pull himself out of the chopper. He pushed the piece of tin roof away from him and resolved to defend his position through the broken windshield. They looked like they were in some little opening, a yard between huts. There was a hut facing him, pieced together with irregularly shaped pieces of corrugated metal, and a small dirt alleyway alongside it. To his side was another flimsy wall, pieced together like the house. Durant remembers seeing Frank sitting in the doorway opposite, about to push himself out. It was the last time he saw him. That's when Shughart and Gordon showed up. Durant was startled. They were suddenly standing there. He'd either been out for a while, or they'd come amazingly fast. He didn't know either of the Delta operators well, but he recognized their faces. Seeing them gave him an enormous sense of relief. It was over. He figured they were part of a rescue team. His next thought had been to get the radio up and operating, but now, with his rescuers already on the ground, there was no need. Shughart and Gordon were calm. There was gunfire, mostly from the choppers overhead. The D-boys reached in and lifted Durant out of the craft gently, one lifting his legs and the other grabbing his torso, as if they had all the time in the world, and set him down on his side by a tree. He was not in great pain. With the airframe and a wall joined behind him, and a wall to his left that ran all the way back behind the tail of the chopper, Durant was in a perfect position to cover the whole right side of the aircraft. He could see that his crew chiefs had taken the brunt of the impact. There were no shock absorbers in back, like the ones he and Frank had up front. He watched the operators lift Bill Cleveland from the fuselage. Cleveland had blood all over his pants and was talking, but making no sense. Then the D-boys moved to the other side of the helicopter to help Field. Durant couldn't see feet moving under the fuselage because the landing gear had been crushed on impact. The belly of the bird was on the dirt. He assumed they were setting up a perimeter over there, looking for a way to get them out. Maybe looking for a place where another helicopter could set down and load them up. Skinnies were starting to poke their heads around the corner on Durant's side of the chopper. Just an occasional one or two. He'd squeeze off a round, and they'd drop back behind cover. His gun kept jamming, so he'd eject the round, and the next time it would shoot okay. Then it would jam again. He could hear more and more shooting now from the other side of the airframe. It still hadn't occurred to him these two D-boys were it, and that there was no rescue team. Chapter 16. When Mo'alim got to the neighborhood where the second helicopter had crashed, the paths leading toward it were already littered with bodies. There were choppers shooting from above, and as Mo'alim had expected, there were still Americans around the crash capable of fighting. There was only one direct approach, and Mo'alim could tell it was covered. He kept trying to hold the crowd back, but they were angry and brazen. The slender, bearded militia leader squatted behind a wall and waited for more of his men to catch up so that they could mount a coordinated attack. Chapter 17. On each of his passes over the wreck, Mike Goffina, in Super 6-2, found the encircling mob larger. Shughart and Gordon had arrayed themselves and the chopper crew in a perimeter around the downed bird. Clearly, they had decided against trying to move the crew to open ground. They were dug in, awaiting help. On the radio, Goffina could hear the desperate problems the rescue convoys were having. The ticking of bullets puncturing his airframe had accelerated, and he was flying through regular RPG airbursts. With two Black Hawks down already, his fellow pilots were warning him away.
"Just had an airburst about 200 meters behind you. RPG passed right under, Super 6-2.
But Goffina was absorbed with the drama unfolding below and trying to get something done about it.
"This place is getting extremely hot," his co-pilot, Captain Yacon, pleaded on the radio. "We need to get those folks out of there." "Roger, 6-2, can you tell what the situation is?" "Taking fairly regular RPG fire, and they're all close."
Yacon continued to direct support fire from the smaller attack helicopters, pointing them where the Somali mobs were thickest. Air Commander Matthews didn't like what he was seeing from the C-2 Black Hawk. RPG smoke trails were arcing up regularly now from the crowd pressing in around Durant's crash site. He had Little Bird pilots hovering over the scene, with co-pilots trying to pick off targets with M-16s.
"Knock that shit off," he said. "You're going to get yourselves shot down."
The battle was at its most confusing point. There were now two crash sites. A rescue team had made it to the first, Cliff Walcott's, and the entire assault force and original ground convoy had been directed to move there. A second hastily assembled rescue convoy had left the ranger base and not gotten far. They were probing around the vicinity of this crash site, but not getting close. The first crash site had a fighting chance, but Durant's, even with the two D-boys they'd dropped in, wouldn't last long without more help. Goffina flew a low orbit over Durant's down Black Hawk. Every time he swung west, he was blinded by the sun. He wished it would hurry and set. He and the other Night Stalkers felt most comfortable flying at night. In the darkness, with their technology, the chopper pilots and crew could see while the enemy could not. If Goffina's Black Hawk and the Little Birds could hold off the mob until nightfall, the men on the ground had a chance. The mob below now filled all the footpaths back out to the main road. Every time Goffina made a low pass, some of the crowd would scatter, but it would close back up behind him. It was like running his hand through water. He could see RPGs now flying past his helicopter very plainly. He saw one of the D-boys get shot.
"This is 6-2, he radioed. "Ground element crash site number 2 has no security right now. They have one guy on the ground."
Then moments later, another plea.
"Are there any ground forces moving to crash site 2 at this time?" Goffina asked. "Negative, not at this time."
On one of his turns back into the slowly setting sun, Goffina's helicopter collided with what felt like a freight train. A resounding crash. It felt like the sky had caved. He had been banking in a steep turn to the right, about 30 feet off the rooftops, going about 110 knots. And the next thing he knew, the airframe was perfectly level.
He saw in front of him what looked like a big piece of a rotor blade. But when his eyes focused, he saw it was a crack in his windshield. He wasn't sure for a moment if he was still flying or on the ground. All the screens in his cockpit were blank. There was a beat of silence. Then he heard all the shrieks and beeps of the chopper's alarm systems, gradually sounding louder and louder, like somebody was slowly turning up the volume. He realized later that the initial RPG blast had deafened him, and that it wasn't the volume turning up. It was the gradual recovery of his hearing. The alarms were telling him that his engines were dead and that his rotors had stopped. But it felt like they were still flying. Gofina realized he had been hit by an RPG on the right side. He couldn't tell if it had been in front or in back. He didn't know if he had anybody left in back. His crew chiefs, Sergeants Paul Shannon and Mason Hall, had not been hurt by this blast. But Sergeant Brad Hollings, the Delta sniper, had his leg almost completely shorn off and was riddled with shrapnel. Captain Yacon, Gofina's co-pilot, hung limp in his seat, head slumped straight down. He didn't know if Yacon was dead or just injured. They were definitely still flying, and Gofina was alert enough to realize that this was a crash sequence. He had practiced this in simulators. They were aloft, but going down fast. He saw a street below, an alley, really. If he could keep the bird heading toward that alley, they might be able to slide down into it. It was so narrow, it would shear off the rotors, but they might impact upright, which was the key. Keep it upright. He saw hard buildings to the left, and the street was fairly wide, but there was a row of poles on the right, and he wasn't going to clear the poles. Maybe only the right rotor system would impact, and maybe it would just shear the rotors. Gofina saw the poles out the right side window, and he was just 20 feet over them, when Yacon came back to life, and shouted into the radio that they were going down and gave grid coordinates. As they cushioned themselves for impact, Gofina began instinctively pulling back on his control stick, trying to keep the nose of the bird up. And he realized suddenly that the helicopter was responding. It wasn't dead. The controls weren't working properly, but he did have some pitch control, enough to keep it in the air. They flew right on over and past the alley and the poles. Gofina held the nose of the bird up, and it continued flying. He had no idea how long they would stay up. Were the engines unwinding? How long would his controls hold out? But the bird stayed fairly level, and the power stayed on. The road beneath them abruptly ended, and what opened in front of him in the distance was what Gofina recognized as the new port facility, Friendly Ground. The helicopter was slowing, and he was now in a gradual descent. He crossed low over the fence around the port and aimed the bird down. They touched ground at about 15 knots, and Gofina was about to congratulate himself on a perfect landing, when the bird, instead of rolling to a stop, just keeled over to the right, crunching metal on sand. The right main landing wheels had been blown off. The chopper skidded, and Gofina worried they would flip. But instead, it just came to a stop, and he shut everything down. As he climbed out of the cockpit to check on the fate of the men in back, he saw the familiar shape of a Humvee racing toward them. Chapter 18. Mike Durant still thought things were under control. His leg was broken, but it didn't hurt. He was lying on his back, propped against a supply kit by a small tree, using his weapon to keep back the occasional skinny who poked his head into the clearing. There was just about a 15-foot space between the wall to his left and the tail of the chopper. Durant admired the way the Delta guy had positioned him. He could hear firing over on the other side of the helicopter. He knew Ray Frank, his co-pilot, was hurt but alive. And there were the two D-boys and his crew chief, Tommy Fields. He wondered if Tommy was okay. He figured there were at least four men on the other side of the bird, and probably more from the rescue team. It was only a matter of time before the vehicles showed up to take them out. Then he heard one of the operators, it was Gary Gordon, cry out that he was hit. Just a quick shout of anger and pain. He didn't hear the voice again. The other one, it was Randy Shughart, came back to Durant's side of the bird. "Are there weapons on board?" he asked. There were. The crew chiefs carried M-16s. Durant told him where they were kept, and Shughart stepped into the craft and rummaged around and returned with both. He handed Durant Gordon's weapon, a Kar-15, loaded and ready to fire. "What's the support frequency on the survival radio?" Shughart asked. It was then, for the first time, that it dawned on Durant that they were stranded. The pilot felt a twist of alarm in his gut. If Shughart was asking how to set up communications, it meant he and the other guy had come in on their own. They were the rescue team. And Gordon had just been shot. He explained standard procedure on the survival radio to Shughart. There was a channel Bravo. He listened while Shughart called out. "We need some help down here," Randy said. He was told that a reaction force was en route. Then Shughart wished him luck, took the weapons, and moved back around to the other side of the helicopter. Durant felt panicked now. He had to keep the skinnies away. He could hear them talking behind the wall, so he fired his weapon into the tin. It startled him because he had been firing single shots, but this new weapon was set on burst. The voices behind the wall stopped. Then two Somalis tried to climb over the nose end of the chopper. He fired at them, and they jumped back. He didn't know if he had hit them or not. A man tried to climb over the wall, and Durant shot him. Another came crawling from around the corner with a weapon, and Durant shot him. Then there came a loud fusillade on the other side of the helicopter that lasted for about 2 minutes. Over the din, he heard Shughart cry out in pain. Then it stopped. Overhead, worried commanders were watching. "Do you have video over crash site number 2? Indigenous personnel moving all around over the crash site?" "Indigenous? That's affirmative. Over." The radio fell silent. Terror washed over Durant. He heard the sounds of an angry mob. The crash had left the clearing littered with debris, and he heard a great shuffling sound as the mob pushed it away like some onrushing beast. There was no more shooting. The others must be dead. Durant knew what angry Somali mobs could do. Gruesome, horrible things. That was now in store for him. His second weapon was empty. He still had a pistol strapped to his side, but he never even thought to reach for it. Why bother? It was over. He was done. A man stepped around the nose of the plane. He seemed startled to find Durant. The man shouted, and more skinnies came racing around. It was time to die. Durant placed the empty weapon across his chest, folded his hands over it, and just turned his eyes to the sky. Chapter 19. Hassan Yassin Abokoy had been shot in the ankle by a helicopter as he stood with the crowd around the crashed helicopter. He now sat beneath a tree watching. His ankle stung at first, and then had gone numb. It was bleeding badly. He hated the helicopters. His uncle that day had his head blown off by a cannon shot from a helicopter. It removed his head neatly from his shoulders, like it had never been there. Who were these Americans who rained fire and death on them, who came to feed them, but then had started killing? He wanted to kill these men who had fallen from the sky, but he couldn't stand. From where he sat, Abokoy could see the mob descend on the Americans. Only one was still alive. He was shouting and waving his arms as the mob grabbed him by the legs and began pulling him away from the helicopter, tearing at his clothes. He saw his neighbors hack at the bodies of the Americans with knives and begin to pull at their limbs. Then he saw people running and parading with parts of the Americans' bodies. When Mo'alim ran around the tail of the helicopter, he was surprised to find another American, a pilot. The man did not shoot. He set his weapon on his chest and folded his hands over it. The crowd surged past Mo'alim toward him and began kicking and beating him, but the bearded fighter felt suddenly protective. He grabbed the pilot's arm and fired his weapon in the air and shouted for the crowd to stay back. One of his men struck the pilot hard in the face with his rifle butt, and Mo'alim pushed him back. The pilot was injured and could not fight anymore. The Rangers had spent months capturing Somalis and holding them prisoner. They would be willing to trade them, perhaps all of them, for one of their own. The pilot was more valuable alive than dead. He directed his men to form a ring around the pilot to protect him from the mob, which was hungry for revenge. Several of Mo'alim's men stooped and began tearing Durant's clothing away. The pilot had a pistol strapped to his side and a knife, and they were afraid he had other hidden weapons, and they knew the American pilots wore beacons in their clothing so that the helicopters could track them, so they stripped the layers away. Chapter 20. Durant kept his eyes on the sky as the mob closed over him. They were screaming things he couldn't understand. When the man struck him in the face with a rifle butt, it broke his nose and shattered the bone around his eye. People pulled at his arms and legs, and then others began tearing at his clothes. They were unfamiliar with the plastic snaps of his gear, so Durant reached down and squeezed them open. He gave himself over to them. His boots were yanked off, his survival vest, and his shirt. A man half unzipped his pants, but when he saw that Durant wore no underwear, for comfort in the equatorial heat, he zipped the trousers back up. They also left on his brown T-shirt. All the while, he was being kicked and hit. A young man leaned down and grabbed at the green ID card Durant wore around his neck. He stuck it in Durant's face and shouted, "Ranger! Ranger! You die, Somalia!" Then someone threw a handful of dirt in his face, which went into his mouth. They tied a rag or towel over the top of his head and eyes, and the mob hoisted him up in the air, partly carrying and partly dragging him. He felt the broken end of his femur pierce the skin in the back of his leg and poke through. He was buffeted from all sides, kicked, hit with fists, rifle butts. He could not see where they were taking him. He was engulfed in a great wave of hate and anger. Someone, he thought a woman, reached out and grabbed his penis and testicles and yanked at them. And in this agony of fright, suddenly Durant left his body. He was no longer at the center of the crowd. He was in it, or above it, perhaps. He was observing the crowd attacking him. Apart somehow. And he felt no pain, and the fear lessened, and then he passed out. The Alamo. Chapter 1. Air Force parajumper Tim Wilkinson climbed back into the wrecked helicopter, looking for a way to get more leverage to free pilot Cliff Wolcott's body. Maybe there was some way he hadn't seen at first to pull the seat back and get more room and a better angle. But it was hopeless. He climbed back out. Kneeling on top of the wreck in the shattering din of automatic weapons fire, he peered down through the open right side doors into the rear of the aircraft. He thought they had accounted for everyone on board. He knew some of the men had been rescued earlier by the little bird that landed right after the crash. So Wilkinson was looking for sensitive equipment or weapons that would have to be removed or destroyed. PJs are trained to quickly erase the memory banks of any electronic equipment with sensitive data. All of the avionics equipment and every piece of gear that hadn't been strapped down had come to rest at the left side of the aircraft, which was now the bottom. In the heap, he noticed a scrap of desert fatigues.
"I think there's somebody else in there," he told Sergeant
Bob Mabry, a Delta medic on the CSAR crew. Wilkinson leaned in further and saw an arm and a flight glove. He called down into the wreck, and a finger of the flight glove moved. Wilkinson climbed back into the wreckage and began pulling the debris and equipment off of the man buried there. It was the second crew chief, the left-side gunner, Ray Dowdy. Part of his seat had gotten slammed and broken off the hinges, but it was still basically intact and in place. When Wilkinson freed Dowdy's arm from under the pile, the crew chief began shoving things away. He still hadn't spoken, and was only half-conscious. Mabry slithered down under the wreck and tried, without success, to crawl in through the bottom left-side doorway. He gave up and climbed in through the upper doors, just as Wilkinson freed Dowdy. The three men stood inside the wreck as a storm of bullets suddenly poked through the skin of the craft. Mabry and Wilkinson danced involuntarily at the sharp burst of snapping and crashing noises. Bits of metal, plastic, paper, and fabric flew around them like a sudden snow squall. Then it stopped. Wilkinson remembers noting first that he was still alive. Then he checked himself. He'd been hit in the face and arm. It felt like he'd been slapped or punched in the chin. Everyone had been hit. Mabry had been hit in the hand. Dowdy had lost the tips of two fingers. The crew chief stared blankly at his bloody hand. Wilkinson put his hand over the bleeding fingertips and said, "Okay, let's get out of here." Mabry tore up the Kevlar floor panels and propped them up over the side of the craft where the bullets had burst through. Instead of braving the fire above, they tunneled out, digging through the dry sand at the rear corner of the left side door. They slid Dowdy out that way. Then the two rescuers climbed back inside, Wilkinson looking for equipment to destroy, Mabry handing out Kevlar panels to be placed around the tail of the aircraft where they had established a casualty collection point. Fire was coming mostly up and down the alley. They were still expecting the arrival of the ground convoy at any moment. Wounded Sergeant Fales was too busy shooting to take notice of the Kevlar pads. He had a pressure dressing on his calf and an IV tube in his arm, and he was lying out by the broken tail boom looking for targets. Wilkinson poked his head out the top.
"Scott, why don't you get behind the Kevlar?"
Fales looked startled. He had been so absorbed firing, he hadn't seen the panels go up behind him.
"Good idea," he said.
Bullet hole after bullet hole poked through the broken tail boom. Wilkinson was reminded of the Steve Martin movie, The Jerk, where Martin's moronic character, unaware that villains are shooting at him, watches with surprise as bullet holes begin popping open a row of oil cans. He shouted Martin's line from the movie, "They hate the cans! Stay away from the cans!" Both men laughed. After patching up a few more men, Wilkinson crawled back up into the cockpit from underneath to see if there was some way of pulling Walcott's body down and out. There wasn't. Chapter 2. A grenade came from somewhere. It was one of those Russian types that looked like a soup can on the end of a stick. It bounced off the car and then off Specialist Jason Coleman's helmet and radio, and then it hit the ground. Nelson, who was still deaf from Twombly's timely machine gun blast, pulled his M60 from the roof of the car and dove, as did the men on both sides of the intersection. They stayed down for almost a full minute, cushioning themselves from the blast. Nothing happened.
"I guess it's a dud," said Lieutenant DiTommaso. 30 seconds later, another grenade rolled out into the open space between the car and the tree across the street. Nelson again grabbed the gun off the car and rolled with it away from the grenade. Everyone braced themselves once more, and this, too, failed to explode. Nelson thought they had spent all their luck. He and Barton were crawling back toward the car when a third grenade dropped between them. Nelson turned his helmet toward it and pushed his gun in front of him, shielding himself from the blast that this time was sure to come. He opened his mouth, closed his eyes, and breathed out hard in anticipation. The grenade sizzled. He stayed like that for a full 20 seconds before he looked up at Barton.
"Dud,"
Barton said. Urich grabbed it and threw it into the street. Someone had bought themselves a batch of bad grenades. Wilkinson later found 3 or 4 more unexploded ones inside the body of the helicopter. The American forces around Walcott's downed Black Hawk were now scattered along an L-shaped perimeter stretching south. One group of about 30 men was massed around the wreck in the alleyway at the northern base of the L. When they learned that the ground convoy had gotten lost and delayed, they began moving the wounded through the hole made by the falling helicopter into the house of Abdiaziz Ali Aden. He was still hidden in a back room. Immediately west of the alley, at the bend of the L, was Marahan Road, where Nelson, Urich, Barton, and Twombly were dug in across the street at the northwest corner. On the east side of that intersection, nearest the chopper, were DiTommaso, Coleman, Bellman, and Delta Captain Bill Coltrop and his radio operator. The rest of the ground force was stretched out south on Marahan Road, along the stem of the L, which sloped uphill. Steele and a dozen or so Rangers, along with 3 Delta teams, about 30 men in all, were together in a courtyard on the east side of Marahan Road, midway up the next block south, separated from the bulk of the force by half a block, a wide alley, and a long block. Sergeant Howe's Delta team, with a group of Rangers that included Specialist Stebbins, followed by the Delta Command Group led by Captain Miller, had crossed the wide alley and was moving down the west wall toward Nelson's position. Lieutenant Perino had also crossed the alley and was moving downhill along the east wall with Corporal Smith, Sergeant Chuck Elliott, and several other men. As Howe approached Nelson's position, it looked to him as though the Rangers were just hiding. 2 of his men ran across the alley to tell the Rangers to start shooting. Nelson and the others were still recovering from the shock of the unexploded grenades. Rounds were taking chips off the walls all around them, but it was hard to see where the shots were coming from. Howe's team members helped arrange Nelson and the others to set up effective fields of fire, and placed Stebbins and machine gunner Private Brian Hurd at the southern corner of the same intersection, orienting them to fire west. Captain Miller caught up with Howe, trailing his radio man and some other members of his element, along with Staff Sergeant Jeff Bray, an Air Force combat controller. With all the shooting at that intersection, Howe decided it was time to get off the street. There was a metal gate at the entrance to a courtyard between 2 buildings on his side of the block. He pushed against the gate, which had 2 doors that opened inward. Howe considered putting a charge on the door, but given the number of soldiers nearby and the lack of cover, the explosion would probably hurt people. So the burly sergeant and Bray began hurling themselves against the gate. Bray's side gave way. "Follow me in case I get shot," Howe said. He plunged into the courtyard and rapidly moved through the house on either side, running from room to room. Howe was looking for people, focusing his eyes at mid-torso first, checking hands. The hands told you the whole story. The only hands he found were empty. They belonged to a man and woman and some children, a family of about 7, clearly terrified. He stood in the doorway with his weapon in his right hand, pointing at them, trying to coax them out of the room with his left hand. It took a while, but they came out slowly, clinging to each other. The family was flex-cuffed and herded into a small side room. Howe then more carefully inspected the space. Each of the blocks in this neighborhood of Mogadishu consisted of mostly one-story stone houses grouped irregularly around open spaces or courtyards. This block consisted of a short courtyard about 2 car lengths wide where he now stood. There was a 2-story house on the south side and a 1-story house on the north. Howe figured this space was about the safest spot around. The taller building would shelter them from both bullets and lobbed RPGs. At the west end was some kind of storage shack. Howe began exploring systematically, making a more thorough sweep, moving from room to room, looking for windows that would give them a good vantage for shooting west down the alley. He found several, but none that offered a particularly good angle. The alley to the north, the same one that the helicopter had crashed into 1 block west, was too narrow. He could only see about 15 yards down in either direction, and all he saw was wall. When he returned to the courtyard, Captain Miller and the others had begun herding casualties into the space. It would serve as their command post and casualty collection point for the rest of the night. As he re-entered the courtyard, one of the master sergeants with Miller told Howe to go back out to the street and help his men. Howe resented the order. He felt he was, at this point, the de facto leader on the ground, the one doing all the real thinking and moving and fighting. They had reached a temporary safe point, a time for commanders to catch their breath and think. They were in a bad spot, but not critical. The next step would be to look for ways to strongpoint their position, expand their perimeter, identify other buildings to take down to give them better lines of fire. The troop sergeant's command was the order of a man who didn't know what to do next. Howe was built like a pro wrestler, but he was a thinker. This sometimes troubled his relationship with authority, especially the Army's maddeningly arbitrary manner of placing unseasoned, less qualified men in charge. Howe was just a sergeant first class, with supposedly narrower concerns, but he saw the big picture very clearly, better than most. After being selected for Delta, he had met and married the daughter of Colonel Charlie A. Beckwith, the founder and original commander of Delta. They had met in a lounge by Fort Bragg, and when he told her that he was a civilian, Connie Beckwith, a former Army officer then herself, nodded knowingly. "Look," she said, "I know who you work for, so let's stop pretending. My dad started that unit." She had to pull out her driver's license to prove who she was. Not that Howe had any ambition for formal Army leadership. His preferred relationship with officers was for them to heed his advice and leave him alone. He was frequently aghast at the failings of those in charge. Take this setup in Mogadishu, for instance. It was asinine. At the base, the huge hangar front doors wouldn't close, so the Sammies had a clear view inside at all hours of the day or night. The city sloped gradually up from the waterfront, so any Somali with patience and binoculars could keep an eye on their state of readiness. Every time they scrambled to gear up and go, word was out in the city before they were even on the helicopters. If that weren't bad enough, you had the Italians, some of them openly sympathetic to their former colonial subjects, who appeared to be flashing signals with their headlights out into the city whenever the helicopters took off. Nobody had the balls to do anything about it. Then there were the mortars. General Garrison seemed to regard mortars as little more than an annoyance. He had walked around casually during the early mortar attacks, his cigar clenched in his teeth, amused by the way everyone dove for cover. "Piddly-ass mortars," he'd said. Which was all well and good, except, as Howe saw it, if the Sammies ever got their act together and managed to drop a few on the hangar, there'd be hell to pay. He wondered if the tin roof was thick enough to detonate the round, which would merely send shrapnel and shards of the metal roof slashing down through the ranks. or whether the round would just poke on through and detonate on the concrete floor in the middle of everybody. It was a question that lingered in his mind most nights as he went to sleep. Then there were the flimsy perimeter defenses. At mealtimes, all the men would be lined up outside the mess hall, which was separated from a busy outside road by nothing more than a thin metal wall. A car bomb along that wall at the right time of day could kill dozens of soldiers. Howe did not hide his disgust over these things. Now, being ordered to do something pointless in the middle of the biggest fight of his life, he was furious. He began gathering up ammo, grenades, and laws off the wounded rangers in the courtyard. It seemed to Howe that most of the men failed to grasp how desperate their situation had become. It was a form of denial. They could not stop thinking of themselves as the superior force, in command of the situation, yet the tables had clearly turned. They were surrounded and terribly outnumbered. The very idea of adhering to rules of engagement at this point was preposterous. "You're throwing grenades?" the troop sergeant major asked him, surprised when he saw Howe stuffing all of them he could find into his vest pockets. "We're not getting paid to bring them back," Howe told him. This was war. The game now was kill or be killed. He stomped angrily out to the street and began looking for Somalis to shoot. He found one of the rangers, Nelson, firing a handgun at the window of the building Howe had just painstakingly cleared and occupied. Nelson had seen someone moving in the window, and they had been taking fire from just about every direction, so he was pumping a few rounds that way. "What are you doing?" Howe shouted across the alley. Nelson couldn't hear Howe. He shouted back, "I saw someone in there." "No shit, there are friendlies in there." Nelson didn't find out until later what Howe had been waving his arms about. When he did, he was mortified. No one had told him that Delta had moved into that space. But then again, it was a cardinal sin to shoot before identifying a target. Already furious, Howe began venting at the Rangers. He felt they were not fighting hard enough. When he saw Nelson, Urick, and the others trying to selectively target armed Somalis in a crowd at the other end of a building on their side of the street, Howe threw a grenade over its roof. It was an amazing toss, but the grenade failed to explode. So Howe threw another, which exploded right where the crowd was gathered. He then watched the Rangers try to hit a gunman who kept darting out from behind a shed about one block north, shooting and then retreating back behind it. The Delta sergeant flung one of his golf ball-sized mini-grenades over the Ranger's position. It exploded behind the shed, and the gunman did not reappear. Howe then picked up a law and hurled it across the road. It landed on the arm of Specialist Lance Twombly, who was lying on his belly 4 or 5 feet from the corner wall. The law bruised his forearm. Twombly jumped to his knees, angry, and turned to hear Howe bellowing, "Shoot the motherfucker!" Down on one knee, Howe swore bitterly as he fired. Everything about this situation was pissing him off. The goddamn Somalis, his leaders, the idiot Rangers, even his ammunition. He drew a bead on 3 Somalis who were running across the street 2 blocks to the north, taking a progressive lead on them the way he had learned through countless hours of training, squaring them in his sights and then aiming several feet in front of them. He would squeeze 2 or 3 rounds, rapidly increasing his lead with each shot. He was an expert marksman and thought he had hit them, but he couldn't tell for sure because they kept running until they crossed the street and were out of view. It bugged him. His weapon was the most sophisticated infantry rifle in the world, a customized Car 15, and he was shooting the Army's new 5.56mm green tip round. The green tip had a tungsten carbide penetrator at the tip and would punch holes in metal, but that very penetrating power meant his rounds were passing right through his targets. When the Sammies were close enough, he could see when he hit them, Their shirts would lift up at the point of impact, as if someone had pinched and plucked up the fabric. But with the green tip round, it was like sticking somebody with an ice pick. The bullet made a small, clean hole, and unless it happened to hit the heart or spine, it wasn't enough to stop a man in his tracks. Howe felt he had to hit a guy 5 or 6 times just to get his attention. They used to kid Randy Shughart because he shunned the modern rifle and ammunition and carried a Vietnam-era M14, which shot a 7.62-millimeter round without the penetrating qualities of the new green tip. It occurred to Howe, as he saw those Sammies keep on running, that Randy was the smartest soldier in the unit. His rifle may have been heavier and comparatively awkward and delivered a mean recoil, but it damn sure knocked a man down with one bullet. And in combat, one shot was often all you got. You shoot a guy, you want to see him go down. You don't want to be guessing for the next 5 hours whether you hit him or whether he's still waiting for you in the weeds. Howe was at a good spot. There was nothing in front or behind him that would stop a bullet, but there was a tree about 20 feet south against the west wall of the street that blocked any view of him from that direction. The bigger tree across the alley where Nelson, Twombly, and the others were positioned blocked any view of him from the north, so the broad-beamed Delta sergeant could kneel about 5 feet off the wall and pick off targets to the north with impunity. It was like that in battle. Some spots were safer than others. Up the hill, Hooten had watched Howe and his team move across the intersection while he was lying with his face pressed in the dirt, with rounds popping all around him. "How can they be doing that?" he'd thought. By an accident of visual angles, one person could stand and fight without difficulty, while just a few feet away, fire could be so withering that there was nothing to do but dive for cover and stay hidden. Howe recognized he'd found such a safety zone. He shot methodically, saving his ammunition. When he saw Perino, Smith, and Elliot creeping down to a similar position on the other side of the street, he figured they were trying to do what he was doing, except on that side of the street there were no trees to provide concealment. He shouted across at them impatiently, but in the din he wasn't heard. Chapter 3 Perino and his men had moved down to a small tin shed, a porch, really, that protruded from the irregular gray stone wall. They were only about 10 yards from the alley where Super 6-1 lay. A West Point graduate, class of 1990, Perino, at 24, wasn't much older than the Rangers he commanded. His group had gotten out ahead of Captain Steele and most of the Ranger force. They had pushed across the last intersection to the crash site after Goodale had been hit. They had cleared the first courtyard they passed on that block, and Perino had then led several of the men back out in the street to press on down Marahan Road. He knew they were close to linking up with Lieutenant DiTomaso and the CSAR team, which had been their destination when they started this move. The shed was just a few steps downhill from the courtyard doorway. Sergeant Elliot was already on the other side of the shed. Corporal Smith was crouched behind it, and Perino was just a few feet behind Smith. They were taking so much fire, it was confusing. Rounds seemed to be coming from everywhere. Stone chips sprayed from the wall over Perino's head and rattled down on his helmet. He saw a Somali with a gun on the opposite side of the street, about 20 yards north of Nelson's position, blocked from those guys' view by the tree they were hiding behind. Perino saw the muzzle flash and could tell this was where some of the incoming rounds originated. It would be hard to hit the guy with a rifle shot, but Smith had a grenade launcher on his M16 and might be able to drop a 203 round near enough to hurt the guy. He moved up to tap Smith on the shoulder. There was too much noise to communicate other than face to face. When bullets began popping loudly through the shed, the lieutenant was on one knee, and a round spat up dirt between his legs. Across the street, Nelson saw Smith get hit. The burly corporal had moved down the street fast and had taken a knee to begin shooting. Most of the men at that corner heard the round hit him, a hard, ugly slap. Smith seemed just startled at first. He rolled to his side and, like he was commenting about someone else, remarked with surprise, "I'm hit." From where Nelson was, it didn't look like Smith was hurt that badly. Perino helped move him against the wall. Now Smith was screaming, "I'm hit! I'm hit!" The lieutenant could tell by the sound of Smith's voice.